is Dr. Richard Stallman, who will be presenting on the subject of copyright and community. Dr. Stallman is the founder of the Free Software Foundation, and it launched the development of the GNU Linux operating system, which is used on tens of millions of computers worldwide. It's received many awards, including the ACM Grasshopper Award and the Electronic Frontier Foundation Pioneer Award, as well as many others and institutions. Present Dr. Richard Stallman.
Is this working? So I got the Pioneer Award about when Gates got the Pie in Face Award. And I think the one I got is more usual. So this, I'm mostly known for my work on free software, which is software that respects your freedom. This is not a talk about free software. This talk addresses an issue that people sometimes raise at the end of the talk on free software. And so, as an introduction, I'm going to have to briefly cover the issue of free software and explain what it's all about. So free software is software that respects the user's freedom and the user's community. So it's free as in freedom, not free as in zero price. So I believe in Dutch that's something like vrije. And I gather that that word doesn't refer to price, so it would be clearer. Specifically, there are four essential freedoms that define free software. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program as you wish. Freedom one is the freedom to study the source code and change it so the program does your computing as you wish. Freedom two is the freedom to help others. That's the freedom to redistribute exact copies of the program to others when you wish. And freedom three is the freedom to contribute to your community. That's the freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions to others when you wish. If the program comes with these four freedoms, it's free software because the social system of using and develop and distributing it is an ethical system, consistent with freedom and social solidarity. But if one of these freedoms is missing, then the program is proprietary software, user-subjugating software, because it imposes an unethical social system on its users. So the distinction between free and proprietary software is not a technical question. It's not a matter directly of what job the program does, although it's true you're less likely to find malicious features in free software. It's not directly about how the code works. It's not about how the code was written. It's not a technical distinction, but a social, ethical, and political distinction, which is why it's more important than any technical distinction could be. So, to develop a free program is more or less a contribution to society. How much, that depends on all the details. To develop a proprietary program is not a contribution, it's a power grab. The proprietary program, in social terms, is a trap, inviting users to surrender their freedom in order to use the program, and thus they fall into the trap. If the program has attractive features, those are the bait for the trap. They don't make it better, they make it more dangerous. So the goal of the free software movement is that all software be free so that all the users of the software can be free. Fundamentally, free software means that the users control the program. The other case, proprietary software, is where the program controls the users. With free software, the users, by means of the four freedoms, have control of the computing that they do with that software. But if they don't have the four freedoms, then they don't effectively control the computing that they do with that software. So who does? The developer or owner controls it, and through that controls the users. So a non-free program is a system of unjust power, power that the developer can use to command, exploit, and abuse the users. Now, if this were a talk about free software, I'd go on to explain why each of those four freedoms is essential. But it's not. This talk is to answer the question that people often raise at the end. They'll ask me, do these ideas apply to anything other than software? Should other things have the same four freedoms? Sometimes they raise this question as wise guys, and they say, what about hardware? Should hardware be free too? Well, obviously they mean the same meaning of free. So let's see if it makes sense for these four freedoms to apply to physical objects that we call hardware. First, there's freedom zero, the freedom to run the program as you wish. That becomes the freedom to use the physical object as you wish. Well, normally if you buy the object, you have the freedom to use it as you wish. So, you generally have freedom zero. What about freedom one? The freedom to study the source code. Oops, there's no source code for most physical objects. They're not made by compiling something. So you can adapt freedom one. You could make it the freedom to study and change the object itself. And that you have. If you buy an object, with rare exceptions, you're free to study and change it. But the ability and practice to do so may be rather limited. For instance, if you bought a glass like this, it would not be easy for you to change it unless you mean breaking it. On the other hand, with a piece of paper, there are some things you could do. You could fold it into a paper airplane. You could paint it. So there are some modifications you could do. With a computer chip, it's impossible to change that. If you tried, you would just destroy it. So, freedom one, in general, to the extent it's physically possible, you have that freedom, but the physical possibility is often very limited or so difficult to exercise, it might as well be impossible. What about freedom two? The freedom to redistribute exact copies. Well, there are no copiers for most physical objects, so this question is meaningless. And likewise, freedom three, the freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions. Suppose you have a wooden chair and you carve on it. Well, that might make it prettier, but there is no chair copy. So there's no way you could distribute copies of your modified chair. So the answer is two of these, well, freedom zero you have, freedom one is rather limited in practice, but you have it, and freedoms two and three are irrelevant in practice because they're about things that we can't do with today's technology. So hardware, it turns out, is not really an interesting question, an interesting domain to ask this question about, but there are other things that we can have, and we can use our computers to copy and change them, and as a result, whether we have the four freedoms becomes a meaningful and important question, a question that is now so important that political parties have been founded about it. And these are works of authorship that you might have a copy of in a file in your computer. What should we be free to do with our copies of works? Now, for the most part, if you have a copy of a work, the only thing that's going to restrict what you can do with it with a published work, because I'm not talking about private things or personal data here. I'm talking about published works that lots of people are expected to have copies of. If you have a copy of one, for the most part, the only thing that restricts you is copyright law. So we can ask the same question looking from the other side by saying, what copyright law should say about the copies of works that we have, copies of published works? To think about this question, it's useful to look at the history of copyright law, which is also connected with the history of copying technology. Now, changes in technology can't affect basic moral principles because those are too deep to be reached by technological changes. But when we apply our principles to a particular question, we do it by looking at the consequences of the choices that are available. Changes in the context, including changes in technology, can alter the consequences of the same action, and that can make it more good or more bad. For instance, if we could reliably resurrect the dead, then murder would no longer be a serious crime. The judge would say, you killed him, you have to pay for his new body. And in the U.S., most of us would need to have uninsured murderer insurance. Except for the poor people who would just be left to die. But in civilized countries, the National Health Service would take care of all that. So let's look at the history of copying technology and copyright law. Copying began in the ancient world, where it was done by reading one copy and writing another. This technology was very inefficient, but it had certain other interesting characteristics. First of all, it had no economy of scale. To make 10 copies would take you about 10 times as long as making one copy. Second, it required no particular skill other than the skill of literacy itself. And third, it required no special equipment other than the equipment you might have used for reading or writing. So the result was that copies were made in a decentralized fashion. Wherever there was somebody who had a copy of a book and wanted another, he could do it if he wanted to go to the trouble. There was nothing like copyright in the ancient world. If you had a copy of a book and you wanted to write another copy, nobody claimed to have the power to stop you, except if the local potentate didn't like that book, in which case, who knows what he might have done to you. But that's not copyright, but rather something closely related, namely censorship. And that's how it was for thousands of years, but then there was an advance in copying technology, the printing press. The printing press made copying far more efficient, but not uniformly so. Because in the ancient world, making many copies and making one copy were equally slow. With the printing press, though, we got this. Making many copies became much more efficient, but making one copy didn't benefit because the fastest way to do that was by hand. This is because the printing technology had an economy of scale. It took a long time to set the type, but once that was done, you could quickly make many identical copies. In addition, the printing press and the type itself were expensive equipment. Most literate people didn't own printing presses. They also didn't know how to run one, which was not trivial. It was a very different skill from being able to read and write. The result of this was that copies were made in a centralized fashion. Copies of any book would be made in a few places, and then they'd be transported to where somebody wanted to buy them. In the first few centuries of printing, a large fraction of all copies were still made by hand. This was done either for very rich people to show how rich they were, or by poor people, because as the song goes, time ain't money if all you got is time. These people couldn't afford printed copies, which were cheaper than buying a handmade copy, but still fairly expensive. And they had enough time available that they could write a copy. Now, copyright developed in the age of the printing press. And I think modern copyright came out of England, where copyright was first started in 1550-something as a system of censorship, specifically censorship of Protestants under Queen Mary. So the law said that before anyone could publish a book, he had to apply to the state for permission. And the permission was granted as a monopoly to that publisher, a perpetual monopoly. It was a very effective system for discouraging publication. But the censorship became obsolete in the 1680s, and the monopoly was allowed to lapse. The publishers didn't like this. They clamored for their monopoly back. But what was adopted instead gave a temporary monopoly to the author. And the idea developed that copyright would be a system to encourage writing. When the U.S. Constitution was drawn up, there was a proposal that authors be entitled to a copyright. This was rejected. Instead, the U.S. Constitution permits a copyright system optionally to be established for the purpose of promoting progress. And it also says that copyright has to last for a limited time. Ever since that decision was made, the publishers have been trying to convince us it never happened. Now, in the age of the printing press, copyright functioned as an industrial regulation. It regulated publishers. The control of this regulation was in the hands of the authors, but it was set up to provide benefits to the general public. Benefits in the form of more books written, published. Because of this, it was easy to enforce, uncontroversial, and arguably beneficial for the public. It was easy to enforce because it only had to be enforced against publishers. And that didn't require invading everybody's home and everybody's internet connection. it's easy enough to find out who's publishing the book. You go to a bookstore and you say, where did these copies come from? You find out who the publisher is. It was uncontroversial because it didn't restrict the readers. The only thing it restricted was publishing. And so, if you weren't publishing, you just didn't notice it. It never got in your way. So, the readers had nothing to complain about. And it was arguably beneficial for the public because notionally it's a trade. The public traded away certain natural rights, the right to copy and publish anything at all, which in practice those who were not publishers couldn't exercise anyway. So it was no loss to them. And in exchange, they got the benefit of more books written, which might actually be of some good. If you have something you can't use and you exchange it with someone else for something of some use to you, at least it's a positive deal. Now, people continued to write copies of books by hand, but no one ever tried to enforce copyright against them, because everyone understood it was supposed to be an industrial regulation. In fact, I know in the US, copyright law didn't even cover writing a copy by hand in the 1800s. But printing presses were mechanized and became much faster, and printing got a lot cheaper. The binding got to be the most expensive thing in the book, so they started making paperback books, which were so cheap that even poor people could generally get them. So, the practice of making copies by hand mostly disappeared, and people forgot that you might ever want to do that. But copyright continued to act essentially as an industrial regulation for. And that's the way it operates with printing press technology. But we now see the slow transition towards other technologies for distributing, copying, and changing works, namely digital information technology. Another advance in copying technology, which once again makes copying more efficient. And once again, in a non-uniform way. Here's the situation we had in the age of the printing press. Mass production, very efficient, and it kept getting more so, but one at a time copying was still very inefficient. With digital technology, we get something like this. They both benefit, but one-off copying benefits more, and they get much closer together, bringing us to a situation more like the ancient world, where there isn't much advantage for mass production anymore, where one-off copying is so efficient now that lots of people do it. They're not exactly equal. For instance, a mass-produced CD is cheaper and more robust than a one-off CD. But one-off CDs are cheap enough and useful enough that hundreds of millions of people make them. This totally changes the effect of copyright law. Even if the words of the law were the same, the consequences would be totally different, because now copyright restricts every computer user. So instead of an industrial regulation on publishers controlled by authors set up to benefit the public, it's now a restriction on the general public effectively controlled by the publishers in the name of the authors. In English, there's a saying that a half-truth is worse than a lie. Nowadays, business is fond of making use of 5% truths, making claims that have just enough little bit of truth in them that you can't call them out and out false. For instance, the claim that they're enforcing their power on the public for the authors. There's just enough tiny bit of truth in that to make it not totally out and out false, but it's mostly false. Mostly the authors are victims too. So the result of this is that it's no longer easy to enforce, no longer uncontroversial, and no longer beneficial for the public. It's no longer easy to enforce because now they want to enforce it against each and every person, and that requires nasty, intrusive measures. It's no longer uncontroversial because the public doesn't like being restricted in this way and is getting more and more energized to fight back. And it's not beneficial because the freedom that we traded away back when we didn't know how to exercise it, we now can exercise. Now it's important for us, and we don't want to trade it away. We won't. So what would a democratic government seeking to serve the people do? It would say, we have to reduce this trade. We have to reclaim for the public some of the public's natural rights that we traded away because in the age of the printing press that was okay. We can measure the sickness of democracy around the world by the tendency of governance to do the exact opposite. Most governments today are governments of occupation for the empire of the megacorporations. And you can see that in their conduct. And it's just as clear in the area of copyright as it might be anywhere else. So what governments have been doing is increasing copyright power in every possible way. For instance, there's a dimension of time. Around the world, there is a campaign to make copyright last longer. The U.S. extended copyright several times in recent decades. The last time was in 1998, when copyright was made 20 years longer for all works both past and future. Now, I don't quite follow how extending copyright on past works made in the 1920s and 30s is going to convince those now dead authors to write more. Perhaps if they have a time machine, they could achieve that. But they haven't used it, because our history books don't record that in the 1920s, when authors discovered that their copyrights would be extended till 70 years after their death, that they got excited and started writing a lot more. Why don't they use their time machine and get us more great classics? Well, for future works, it's conceivable that extending the copyright could motivate someone to write something that she otherwise wouldn't have. But only if the author is very irrational and foolish, because in economic terms, the discounted present value of 20 more years of copyright so far in the future is so tiny that it wouldn't be a motive for anybody to do anything. And the real reason for that copyright extension was there were companies that had lucrative monopolies, and they didn't want those monopolies to end, so they paid Congress to extend them. Laws in the U.S. are for sale by Congress to business. And typically there'll be businesses on each side. It's a matter of who pays more. So they extended copyright for 20 more years, and that made sure that the character, the image of Mickey Mouse, would not go into the public domain. Disney was one of the companies that was paying for that law. But that's not going to last forever. I expect that in 2018 they will try to extend it for 20 more years, or maybe 100 more years, if they can get away with it. Their plan is that no copyright should ever expire again. And in some countries, they've gone much further. Mexico has copyright lasting until 100 years after the author's death. Just think of that. An author who died before you were born, and you'll never be free to copy those works until after you're dead. And a couple of years ago, there was a move in the European Union to extend the copyright on sound recordings. And I don't remember what ultimately happened, but I suppose they probably succeeded.
95 years.
Really? So they made it a lot longer. So, yeah, basically people are not organized enough to fight back. So that's one dimension of copyright, length of time. The other is breadth. Which uses does copyright apply to? In the age of the printing press, copyright was not supposed to cover all uses of a copyrighted work. There were certain uses covered by copyright, and those were the exceptions in a broader space of unregulated use. So the publishers have recognized that digital technology gives them a chance to impose total control, to set up a pay-per-view universe and impose it on all of us using digital restrictions management, or DRM, also known as digital handcuffs. Technology designed to restrict the user. Now, such malicious features are found in proprietary software. They're not found in free software, because with free software, the users have control. And if the users don't want to be restricted, they get rid of the restrictions. So only proprietary software, with its fundamental injustice, provides a platform for the further injustice of DRM. Thus, DRM attacks users' freedom at two levels. It's implemented in non-free software, which attacks the user's freedom by being non-free. It denies users the freedom to change that software. And then the specific feature implemented in it, the DRM feature, is designed to attack users' freedom in using their copies, in using the data that they have in their computers. People generally encounter DRM for the first time with DVDs. DVDs are designed so that the movie can be stored encrypted, so that only a special kind of program would be able to play the video. And the encryption format was kept secret to make this effectively restrict the users. And this was set up by the DVD conspiracy, which said, if you want to manufacture DVDs, you're going to have to join the conspiracy, promising to keep all the format secret and to build the DVD players so that they restrict the user just like all the other DVD players. So that's why there's little effective competition in DVD players. They're required to be banned in the same ways. And then some people found out the format and released a free program capable of reading and decrypting the video from a DVD. The movie companies didn't like that. So they decided to make that free software, well, they decided to censor free software. And the first place they did it was in the US with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which makes it illegal to distribute anything that can break digital handcuffs unless it has some other significant commercial value. Note that cultural, social, ethical value are defined as legally insignificant. Only commercial value counts, which is effectively a statement that the U.S. government works for business and considers us citizens to be just something to step on. And then this policy spread to the European Union and to various other countries through trade treaties with the US. Trade treaties nowadays are almost always attacks on human rights, and they're always an attack on democracy. So every trade treaty that governments would consider making nowadays is bad and should be torn up. I can imagine, theoretically, trade treaties that would be good, but governments under the influence of big business are not going to make treaties like that. The treaties they're going to make are the ones that give business increased power at the expense of democracy. It's no accident that democracy is so sick around the world. It's the consequence of these treaties. The more treaties make it easy for a company to move operations from one country to another, the more of a threat the companies can make to demand that countries and states obey the dictates of business. And the result is that you see no effective opposition, no real disagreement about anything important, because businesses are dictating the things that are important, and the treaties control them, and politics is left to be about things that business doesn't care about. So, but despite these laws, that software remains easy to get. So the movie companies realized they couldn't make it disappear, and they designed another form of encryption that they thought would never be broken, which is AACS. And that's used in Blu-ray discs. And we all thought it would never be broken, but then someone released a free program that could do this decryption. However, it was lawful because it was useless. Without knowing the key, you couldn't actually use it. And then someone found the key. I saw a photo of two adorable puppies. And above those puppies were 32 hex digits. And I wondered, why did someone put these two things together? I wonder if that number is a key for something important. And they put the number with the puppies, figuring people would save the photos of these cute puppies. That's what it was. That was the key to break the axe. There were attempts to censor this. They tried very hard, but after a few weeks, this was found on 700,000 web pages, showing how much people are angry at DRM. So they changed the key. It didn't win the war. It was just one ploy in a long game. If you value your freedom, do not use Blu-ray discs. You must never accept and use a product designed to attack your freedom. People who are willing to give up their freedom for some sort of convenience of that product, they're going to lose all their freedom. If you want to keep your freedom, you've got to be quick to say no. So never use a product designed to attack your freedom unless you personally have the means to defeat the attack, to break the handcuffs. So if you've got the free program that can decrypt the video on a DVD, then use DVDs. I prefer actually not to have that program, and I don't use any encrypted DVDs. I don't have anything that can play them. I don't own any, and if somebody gave you one, I'd throw it away. So, in addition to the fact that they changed the key, some Blu-ray discs have another level of DRM, which they change every few months. And as a result, it looks hopeless to try to break it in free software. There's just no keeping up. So the only thing we can do is recognize them as poison. And nowadays, Flash is being used in a similar way. There are sites that distribute video as using complicated Flash programs that make it impossible to figure out what format the video is really in. I suppose in theory someone could, but it's just not, it's too hard in practice. Well, that's DRM in the area of video. But we've also seen DRM in music. Around 10 years ago, we started to see things that looked like compact discs, but they were not written following the standard for compact discs. So we call them corrupt discs. And they were designed to play in audio CD players, but not be readable by a computer. And so people had to publish lists of these, what you shouldn't buy. But in some countries in Europe, you could tell what they were because they didn't have the CD, the usual compact disc logo. It was illegal to put that logo on them because they weren't written following the standard. So instead they would say something else, like copy control. And once I gave a speech on this topic in Spain, where I'd been invited by an agency of a regional government. And so of course they gave me some books with photos of the region, and they gave me some CDs with music of the region. And one of them was by someone I heard of, so I wanted to listen to it, but fortunately, before I opened the package, I saw the symbol copy control. This disc can be played on Windows and Macintosh systems, meaning with proprietary software. So, and that implied it was DRM. So I gave it back, and I said, please return this to the store because they shouldn't be able to keep your money. Here you see the face of the enemy. And I've never heard that music, and I guess I never will. But that's a tiny sacrifice to make for freedom. Sony had a clever idea for corrupt discs. They wrote the discs so that if they were put into a computer, they would install a program and run it. Well, and that program was similar to what's used in a virus or used by a cracker to take control of the system. It's called a rootkit, which is basically a program that exploits bugs to take control of the system and then alter the system. And this program installed parts of itself into the system, and it changed various things. First of all, it restricted the use of anything read from these disks. Second, it modified the program you would use to investigate what's in the system so it wouldn't show that this had been installed. Third, it modified the command you would use to remove this software so that it wouldn't really remove this software. And all of this is a serious crime. It's the same crime as releasing a virus, basically. But it wasn't the only serious crime Sony committed. Because part of this code was software that had been released under the GNU General Public License. Now, the GNU General Public License is one among many free software licenses. But what's special about it is it's a copyleft license. It says when you put some of this code into some other program, the entire program has to be released under the GNU GPL, and you must provide the users with the complete source code. You must give them a copy of the license so that they know their rights. Sony didn't do these things. That's commercial copyright infringement. So Sony could have been prosecuted, but wasn't, because the officials understand the purpose of laws is to ensure the power of companies over people, not to protect our rights. So they didn't prosecute. However, the people who had installed these disks sued Sony. Unfortunately, they focused their condemnation not on the malicious purpose of this nasty software, but rather on the secondary nastinesses that were part of the method used. And that enabled Sony to settle the lawsuit by promising that in the future when it attacks our freedom, it won't do these other nasty things. And Sony has learned its lesson, because in the future, the rootkit will be called AACS, and it will be installed in the computer before you get it, and it will be impossible to remove. And that's how it was supposed to be in an extremely vicious product, PlayStation 3. Now, Sony will has no scruples at all about abusing the purchasers of that product. A year or two ago, somebody figured out a way to install, it had a feature to let you install other operating systems on top of their user-restricting digital handcuff level. But then somebody found a way to get through that, so they took out the feature that you could run other operating systems. They told all the customers, you can't do that anymore. And if you don't install the firmware downgrade that's going to stop you from doing that, turn off the feature entirely, then we're going to break other things for you. Now, that obviously should be illegal too, but these arrogant companies believe they can get away with doing anything at all. And then a little while ago, people found a way to crack these restrictions entirely, and Sony is vigorously trying to find everybody who downloaded that information, everybody who searched for it. It's a witch hunt, and they probably hope to terrorize thousands of people. So that's I think the nastiest product I know of, and nobody should consider buying one of those. Anyway, then we started seeing DRM in music downloads. Apple pioneered that. Apple is generally a pioneer in technology designed to restrict the user. And then DRM mostly disappeared for music, and Apple was indirectly responsible. It turns out the contract between the record companies and Apple worked out to the disadvantage of the record companies. They didn't like that, but they wanted to get out from it, but they were stuck. And the contract didn't allow them to sell the downloads themselves with DRM. So they tried selling downloads without DRM. And lo and behold, the horrible predictions didn't occur. They were able to sell more than one copy. They sold lots of copies. So they said, okay, I guess this is okay. So they started just selling music without DRM, and Apple felt compelled to go along with them and pretended that it was championing our rights. So DRM mostly disappeared from music, and they gave up on the corrupt discs too. But it's starting to show itself again. There are now music streaming services where they send the music to your machine and your machine plays it as in parallel with the transfer. And they require you to use a non-free program so that it can restrict you by refusing to save a copy of the same data in a file. And they want people to think that somehow, because it's being played in real time, that somehow naturally means it's not going to be saved in a file. That's ridiculous. Saving in the file would be the obvious, natural, easy thing to do. But they won't, and that's why they make you use non-free software to use these services. So, out, out, damn Spotify. Sometimes we can defeat DRM, but they tend to keep trying to bring it back. So we can't ever relax. We can't ever assume DRM is dead, we're safe. As long as there are companies that think they can make money by getting us to accept DRM, they'll find a shiny way to package it again. And we've also seen DRM attack the field of books. They tried 10 years ago. There was a large, clearly coordinated PR campaign to try to convince people that they would love ebooks. Ebooks equipped with digital handcuffs, of course. And then there was a publisher that had the idea that it could really make its line of user-restricting encrypted ebooks start off with a bang by starting it with a biography of me. So they found an author who came and to ask for my cooperation, and I said, only if this ebook is not encrypted and people can copy it. He went back to the publisher, which would not agree. So I said no. And then we found another publisher who was willing, who wanted to publish it on paper, but also release the text on the net under a free license. So the book got written and sold for several years. And the Free Software Foundation has recently published a revised edition. So if you look at fsf.org, you can order that. In any case, ebooks were a failure 10 years ago. People just didn't want to use them very much, and they gave up. They dropped all these products. And I said, they're not defeated. We just drove them off. They'll be back. We have to organize now to defeat them next time. And they came back with products such as the Sony Shredder, and the then there's another one that we call the Schnook, and then there's the Amazon Swindle, which is designed to swindle readers out of the traditional freedoms of readers. For instance, the freedom to acquire a book anonymously, paying perhaps with cash. It's impossible to acquire most modern books anonymously for the swindle, because the only place to get them is from Amazon. And Amazon requires customers to identify themselves. So Amazon maintains a large list of all the books every customer has bought, which means all the books they've read if they're reading on the swindle. And that list is such a threat to human rights, we cannot tolerate its existence anywhere. And then there's the freedom to give, lend, or sell the book to someone else. Freedoms that Amazon takes away using digital handcuffs and total disrespect for private property. Amazon says that you can't really buy a copy and own it. No, all you can do is license permission to read a copy. So Amazon doesn't want us to own any books either. And then there's the freedom to keep a book as long as you wish and keep reading it and eventually pass it on to your heirs, which Amazon takes away through a back door in the swindle. We discovered this back door by observation. People noticed that their books disappeared. Amazon can use this back door to remotely delete books. And these were authorized copies. They had been purchased or perhaps officially licensed from Amazon that Amazon made disappear. And the book with which Amazon demonstrated the Orwellian nature of this product was 1984 by George Orwell. So then there was a lot of bad publicity, and Amazon said, we will never do this again unless the state tells us to. How comforting. The official name of this product is the Kindle. Kindle means to start a fire. Evidently, this is a product conceived to burn our books. This product is an attack on society. Imagine visiting a friend and there are no books. And it's not because your friend doesn't read, but rather because all his books are in some device. And the only way he could lend you a book is to lend you the whole device. Or perhaps if you use the same kind of device, he could do something saying to Amazon that it could transmit the book temporarily to you. And then Amazon would know that you had been roped into the same scheme, which isn't really lending, and it isn't freedom. So we need to defeat these encrypted ebooks. As far as I'm concerned, they don't exist as an option. I'll never pay for a book with a credit card. But I don't mind buying a download if I can, if in terms of freedom, it's no different from buying a physical copy. If I can pay for it with cash and it has no DRM and it doesn't say that it has some license it imposes on me, then okay. But they're not setting up to make that kind of thing possible. I keep trying to find publishers who will be willing to participate in that. So we've encountered DRM in lots of media, and it's an ongoing fight. And we have to do more than just reject it individually. After all, these forms of DRM are designed and imposed by conspiracies of companies, conspiracies intending to restrict the public's access to technology. Such conspiracies ought to be punished by imprisonment, just like conspiracies to restrict prices. But they know that our governments are on their side against us. So they don't even bother to hide. How do I know about these conspiracies? I'm no investigator. If they had a secret conspiracy, I'd never find out. But they have websites where they proudly announce these conspiracies. I visited the website for AACS so that I could look at some of the rules that they impose on the makers of Blu-ray discs. For instance, it's either this year or in 2013 that the requirements said that analog video outputs have to be eliminated. This is to close, they say, to close the analog hole. Let me show you a couple of the analog holes they would like to close. And it also listed the names of the companies that founded the conspiracy. And they included Intel and AMD and IBM and Microsoft and Apple and Sony and I think Philips. And there's one other I can't remember. So they are conspiring to attack you. So we need to get together and organize to fight back, and that's why we started defectivebydesign.org, which is a campaign of protests against digital handcuffs. Now, digital handcuffs are very common in proprietary software. The most common proprietary software packages have digital handcuffs. Microsoft Windows implements digital handcuffs. Mac OS, the newer Apple products, the iGrown and the iBad, carry digital handcuffs to the point where they even restrict the installation of applications. Users are not free to install whatever applications they wish. They can only install what's approved by Apple. And then there's the Adobe Flash Player, which implements digital handcuffs, as well as surveillance features. And then all those ebook readers. And So the result is that most of the time when somebody is using proprietary software, he is the victim of malicious features. This is not a rare, it's not one of those rare things that is impossible to completely eliminate, like the danger of being robbed if you go out on the street. This is the usual case, and shows the malice inherent in proprietary software. So these are the nasty things that governments have been doing to copyright law. Instead of prohibiting digital handcuffs, which they ought to do, they are prohibiting us from breaking digital handcuffs, showing that they're on the side of companies that want to subjugate us. What would governments do if they wanted to serve the people? They would reduce copyright power, but how? Here are my recommendations. First of all, there's the dimension of time. I recommend making copyright last for 10 years, starting from the date of publication. Why from the date of publication? Because before a work is published, we don't have copies, so we're not really losing anything if we're not allowed to copy the copies we don't have. And it's a moot point. So why not let the author have as long as it takes to arrange publication and then start the clock? Why 10 years? Because at least in the US, but I think in some other countries as well, the usual publication cycle lasts less than 3 years. Within 2 years, a work is remaindered, and within three, it's out of print. Well, 10 years is more than three times the usual publication cycle, and I think that means it will be adequate, comfortably so. It's a very small fraction of works that would still be in print that long. However, not everyone agrees with that proposal. I once made these suggestions in a panel discussion with fiction writers. And I expected some friction, and I got some. An award-winning fantasy writer said, 10 years, no way, anything more than 5 years is intolerable. I was surprised too. Oh, I don't know if I want to say, but I did read a book of his and I liked it a lot. In any case, he had a legal dispute with his publisher. His contract said, this is what he told us then, that if his books went out of print, the rights would revert to him. His books appeared to be out of print because his fans reported they couldn't get any copies. But the publisher refused to acknowledge that and was using the copyright on his own works to stop him from distributing copies, which he wanted to do so people could read them. He published works and wanted people to appreciate them. I think just about every artist starts out with that wish. And a handful gets so rich that it corrupts them totally, and they start being more, for them, more money is more important than appreciation of their work. But that's rare, because almost all the artists never get enough money to be corrupted, and they continue mainly wanting people to appreciate their work. He knew that more than 5 years of copyright was not likely to ever do him any good, but it could do him harm. Well, if everyone else wants copyright to last 5 years after the publication date, I'm willing to go along with that. I don't say 10 years is exactly right. I couldn't tell you what the best length of time is. I'm suggesting it as a good approximation and thus I suggest trying that first. First, let's set it up as 10 years, and after some years of experience, we can see if we want to adjust it further. That's the dimension of time. What about breadth? Which uses of a work should copyright cover, and what things should we be free to do? For this, I distinguish three broad categories of works based on what kind of contribution they make to society. There are works of practical use that you use to do a job. There are the works of testimony that show the thoughts of particular people and represent them. And then there are works of art and entertainment whose contribution is in the impact of the work itself. And I have different recommendations for these, for each category. First of all, there are the works of practical use, the works that whose contribution is they enable you to do a job. This doesn't mean there is no aesthetic aspect of these works. Sometimes there is, but that's secondary, because what's important is they do the job. And these include software, recipes, educational works, reference works. And these works have to be free, because if you use a job in your life in order to control your own life, which is what freedom means, you have to control the work you're using. So you've got to be free to use the work freely to do jobs. You've got to be free to change it so it does the job the way you want. But then once you've changed it, you've got to be free to publish your version, because it may be useful to some others, just as it was useful to you. However, if we allow publication of modified versions, it's futile and ridiculous to try to stop republication of the unchanged work, because that would just make people figure out ways to make changes that don't really alter anything, so that they can get permission to publish it. And it's just senseless. So we end up concluding that all four of the freedoms are essential. And thus, it's no coincidence that software is in this category. Software is an example of why these four freedoms are needed. And then look at recipes. Cooks use recipes as if they had the four freedoms. They cook the recipe freely. It's common to study the recipe and change it, of course. Some people have more skill for changing the recipe in a useful way, and some can only make little changes, like me. But the point is, any of us is welcome to do so. And then cooks frequently share recipes with each other. And if you've changed a recipe, and you cook it for your friends and they like it, and they say, well, could we have the recipe? You can distribute your copies of your version. Well, these are the same four freedoms. Imagine if the state were to tell cooks, starting today, if you copy or change a recipe, we'll call you a pirate and put you in prison. I wouldn't be surprised if they reached that point in another 10 years of the war on sharing. But they've never tried to do this for recipes thus far. And then someone might raise the objection despair and defeatism, saying, we have to give up our freedom or they won't make enough works. And 20 years ago, one might have thought that was true. We had no evidence they were wrong. But today, if you look at the tremendous success of the free software community with tens of thousands of useful free programs, and then there are all the recipes that cooks are sharing, as if they were free. And then in the area of reference works, we see great free reference works such as Wikipedia. And there are even starting to be free educational works. So it's clear now that we don't have to surrender our freedom. We should stand firm, and we will develop the works we want to use. And the more we encourage this, the clearer it will be that we don't need to give up our freedom, and we should refuse. But what about the second category, the works that represent somebody's thinking? That's a totally different issue. These include memoirs, essays of opinion, scientific papers, because a scientific paper says that certain people did certain things and saw certain results. They're putting their names on the line. To modify these works, to publish a modified version of someone else's work of testimony, is to misrepresent that person. I don't think that that's a contribution to society. So that I see no reason why it needs to be legal. And that means there's no compelling reason to permit commercial republication of unmodified works either. And that means we can, leaving so soon, that means we could use, thank you for coming back. Makes me feel much better. So that means we could have a reduced copyright system that covers all commercial use and all modification. But the freedom that people must have is the freedom to non-commercially redistribute exact copies. In other words, to share. Because sharing is good, and sharing creates the bonds of society. So we must not allow anyone to attack sharing. To attack sharing is to attack society. And the war on sharing is what has turned copyright into such a nasty system. Because it's hard to get people to stop sharing. Sharing is natural and obviously good. If you want to convince people that it's bad, you have to tell them absurd lies, by telling them that copying is theft. And that if you share, you're a pirate. In other words, helping other people is the moral equivalent of attacking ships. These things are totally absurd, but they repeat them and repeat them, and not enough people dare to say it's absurd. And so even if they don't fully convince most people, they make them have doubts. So we need to teach other people sharing is good. Those are just a bunch of nasty companies trying to divide you and control you. So don't listen to them and fight back. So our governments should end the war on sharing. They should legalize sharing. In fact, this minimum freedom has to apply to any published work. The freedom to non-commercially redistribute exact copies. But for this category, I think that's as far as it needs to go. And so this reduced copyright system covering commercial use and modification would continue to provide revenue to the authors, or at least some of them, in more or less the same lousy fashion as the existing copyright system, which also only provides income to some of the authors, and not very well. But what about the third category of artistic and entertainment works, whose contribution is in the impact they make? Here, modification is a difficult question, because there are arguments on both sides that I see having validity. On the one hand, a work can have an artistic integrity, and changing it could destroy that integrity. I think that is sometimes true. although not as often as the artists will say, especially when you consider that most of them are perfectly willing to let Hollywood butcher their works in exchange for enough money. But some of them seem to put real control on Hollywood and don't let Hollywood turn the work inside out, and I guess they do have artistic integrity. So there is some truth in that argument. On the other hand, modifying an artistic work can be a contribution to art. Consider the folk process, where a series of artists can transform a work and produce something very rich. But if we want to look at named authors, consider Shakespeare. Some of Shakespeare's plays used stories that were borrowed from or copied from other works published decades before. If today's copyright law had been in effect then, that would have been illegal, and those works would not have been written. And if Shakespeare had complained, or whoever it was that really wrote those plays, then the copyright holders would have said, oh, he just wants to make a cheap ripoff of my work. And since this would never have been written, we would have no way of looking at it and judging whether it is a cheap ripoff or not. But since, in fact, they were written, we can look at them and say they're important literature. So, don't believe those people when they say it's just going to be a cheap ripoff. In any case, modifying an artistic work can be a contribution to art, but it can wait 10 years. So we could have for 10 years from the publication of a work the reduced copyright system that covers all commercial use and all modification, but people are free to non-commercially redistribute exact copies, which is sharing. And then after 10 years, the copyright would expire and people would be free to do whatever they like, including publish modified versions. I'll have the questions at the end, please. So you can't wait for copyright to expire with today's system, because you have to wait till after you were dead. But you can wait 10 years, and that's the most you have to wait. Maybe you make your modified version 5 years after the original was published. Well, then you only have to wait 5 years. You can wait that long. So if that does some good for society by giving income to the artists, okay, I figure I'm willing to wait 5 or 10 years like that. So that's most of my recommendation, except for one other point. Remix, the practice of taking a lot of pieces of various works and putting them together into something totally different overall from those other works. Now, since the purpose of copyright is to promote the arts, to interpret it in a way that interferes with remix is absurd. It's a kind of absurdity that can only happen if the system is corrupted by interests of business and gets twisted so that it no longer serves its stated purpose. Remix should simply be legal. The result should be considered a new work, and where the little snippets came from, it's irrelevant. Now, to end the war on sharing means legalizing sharing. Sharing should be legalized, including sharing on the internet. The record companies would say, but that means you're stealing from the musicians. No, we can't steal from the musicians because the record companies steal from them, and they steal everything from the musicians, with very few exceptions. When I buy a commercial CD, which is the main way I get copies of music, I feel ashamed to know I'm not supporting the musicians. Because the only case where you're supporting the musicians are, A, the musician sells it to you, or B, they are long-established superstars for their newer recordings. The reason is that the record companies impose totally exploitative contracts on musicians. According to these contracts, a certain fraction of the price is for the musicians, but they never get it, because the production and publicity expenses are treated as an advance to the musicians. And so when you buy a record, that fraction goes to partially repay the so-called advance. But it's almost unheard of that that advance gets fully repaid. Even for records that go gold or platinum, it may never fully repay the so-called advance, which means that your purchases of records never give the musicians anything. Well, if that band finishes its contract of 5 or 7 albums, then it can, being stars, they can negotiate a contract that doesn't exploit them and that really pays them some money if you buy their record. But that doesn't apply to the older records. Those remain under the control of the contract under which they were published. So it's only in that very special case that the musicians get any money when you buy the record. So it's something to feel somewhat ashamed about. In any case, given this, I don't think the record companies have a right to complain at all. In fact, these are the companies, these major record companies, that sued teenagers for hundreds of thousands of dollars. The only thing these companies deserve is to be wiped out, to be destroyed. They deserve to cease to exist and have their assets disappear. I have nothing against making and selling records. And it might be good to have a kind of copyright system that really would make these record companies pay the musicians, which they don't now. But the major record companies of today, they deserve to be wiped out for their vicious attacks on society. You might also wonder, having heard the tremendous sums stated as the cost of making movies, whether movies could be made under this reduced copyright system. Well, I think they can be, because those sums are exaggerated twice. First of all, according to a producer I spoke with, more than half of this cost is actually publicity, not making the movie. And surely the publicity could be done in other cheaper ways. And second, even beyond that, it has been inflated by creative accounting. Because the higher the company can make the cost figure, the less money it has to pay in taxes and to investors. So the studio has every reason to use various accounting tricks to make the cost seem much larger than it really was. That's one side of it. The other side of it is that a lot of use of movies is commercial use and would be covered under my proposed reduced copyright system in the same way as it is now. For instance, playing them in airplanes and buses and trains, broadcasting them on TV, showing them in theaters. It's a bit strange to think of showing movies in theaters, perhaps, but it still happens a lot. So all these things they would have to pay just as they do currently, because the change that I'm proposing would have no effect on them. So, putting those two things together, I think they'd still do it. However, I don't feel tremendously concerned about the question. And the reason is that Hollywood systematically makes crap. And I say systematically because why is it that Hollywood movies are almost always crap? It's not because they're always trying to do a good job, but it's just so hard that they always get it wrong. No, it's the system that makes it come out as crap. And I found out about the details of why in a book called Save the Cat, whose stated purpose was to teach people how to write screenplays and sell them to Hollywood. I wasn't interested in doing that, but the book, in the course of teaching people how to play a role in the system, explained the system. And that showed why, if Hollywood buys it, it's crap. That Hollywood filters to collect crap and reject anything that isn't. So, that's no reason to stop them. I'm totally against censorship. And I campaign against censorship. Censorship is a big threat in Europe today. For instance, a couple of days ago, I read that a TV presenter in France had been convicted of a crime for expressing some political opinions, which I disagree with, but that's irrelevant. It's censorship and it's tyranny. There are pushes to impose censorship of various different things in the European Union. It's a big danger. But the question is not whether to forbid Hollywood from making crap. The question is whether we should give up the freedom we deserve to help Hollywood continue to make crap. And there, my answer is no. I won't give Hollywood power. I won't acquiesce in Hollywood's having power so that it can continue to make its crap. In any case, I've argued that we can legalize sharing and that there will still be art. But we might want to support artists better than the existing lousy system. I have two proposals for that. One works through tax money. The state could distribute a certain amount of money among artists based on their success, which means no bureaucrat deciding arbitrarily who should get how much. It's controlled by measurements done by polling and so on. But the crucial thing is, don't distribute the money in linear proportion to popularity. And the reason is, a superstar can be far, far more popular than a fairly successful artist. And if you distribute the money in linear proportion, the superstar, say, might get 1,000 times as much money as mere fairly successful artists. And that's not efficient use of the money to support the arts. So what I suggest is to use a function that tapers off, like maybe cube root. And that way, well, if you have zero popularity, you get zero. If you have sufficient popularity, you get enough to live on. And if you're more popular, you do get more. But the superstar who's 1,000 times as popular as fairly successful art, superstar A, who's 1,000 times as popular as fairly successful, good artist B, would get 10 times as much money, not 1,000 times. The result is that the money, the sum that is appropriated for this purpose, would support adequately a much larger number of musicians, because it wouldn't have to make a few superstars rich. And the result is we can support artists much better with less money. First of all, it wouldn't be supporting these corporations that aren't necessary. Second, it wouldn't be making the superstars rich, so there'd be a lot more for the other artists who are fairly successful and fairly popular. It could support them adequately, whereas the present system doesn't. And you could do all this with much less money. And that's why we don't really have to worry about where the tax money will come from. It could be from a special tax. It could be from the general budget. It won't, because it's a small amount of money, it's not an important question. Either one will work. But there's another method that I can propose based on voluntary payments. Suppose each player had a button. You could push the button and it would send €1 to the people that made the work currently playing or the last work that you played. And you could push that button if you like, if you feel like it. If you watch or listen to something and you think, oh, that was great, push the button. And you'll feel good. And the amount of money is so small, you wouldn't hesitate. You could push that button every day, and it wouldn't be a problem. Now, there are some people who couldn't afford to push that button every day, or maybe even every week. There are poor people, and they won't push it, and that's good. It's fine. There's no need to squeeze money out of poor people to support artists. There are enough non-poor people who will be happy to support artists. Of course, the payments should be sent and transferred anonymously. We shouldn't be required to identify ourselves when we pay. And if we would like people to do this more often, we could encourage it with a warm, cheerful PR campaign. Have you sent €1 to some artist today? Why not? It's such a small amount of money, you'll never miss it. And you'll feel good rewarding the people who made you feel good. And contrast this with the vicious and cruel propaganda of the war on sharing. It's based on twisted morality. This encourages people to do something that they'll feel good when they do. So that is my talk. Before questions, I'd like to mention that you can get more information about the GNU operating system, often mistakenly referred to as Linux, at GNU.org. And you can find information about free software, and you can also help at FSF.org. That stands for Free Software Foundation. There is also Free Software Foundation Europe at FSFE.org. And both of these organizations would like your support. You can join as a member and pay dues. I'm a full-time volunteer. The FSF doesn't pay me, but there are also paid staff, and you can help us continue to pay them this way. You can join through the websites if you wish to use e-commerce, but if you want, you can pay in cash here and become an FSF member. There are things for sale out there, and the money goes to the FSF. The stickers, however, are gratis, so take them and use them in places people will see them. Now, there is also defectivebydesign.org, where you can sign up to help our campaign against digital restrictions management. Now, this is an adorable GNU, which needs some help. So I'm going to auction this for the benefit of the Free Software Foundation. And we can accept payment using credit cards or cash. And if you are the purchaser of the GNU, and I can sign either the card or the body, it's easier to see on the card. And if you have a penguin at home, you need a GNU. A penguin can hardly function without a GNU. So, if you bid, please wave your arm and shout the number you're bidding so that I can, because you want me to notice. So make sure I notice. And I'm going to start at 20 euros. Do I get 20 euros? How much are you bidding? Okay, I've got 20 euros. Do I get 25?
40.
I've got 40. Do I get 45? How much?
50.
I've got 50. Do I get 55? I've got 50. Do I get 55?
60.
I've got 60. Do I get 65? I've got 60 euros. Do I get 65? Do I get 65? Are you bidding? I've got 70. Do I get 75? I've got 75. Do I get 80? I've got 75. Do I get 80? I've got 75 euros. Do I get 80? I've got 80. Do I get 85? Do I get 85 euros? I've got 80 euros. Do I get 85? Are you bidding 85? I've got 85. Do I get 90? I've got 85. Do I get 90? Do I get 90? I've got 85. Do I get 90?
Yeah.
I've got, how much are you bidding? I've got 90. Do I get 95? I've got 90. Do I get 95 euros for this adorable so long. I've got 90. Do I get 95? Do I get 95?
100.
I've got 100. Do I get 110? Do I get 110? I've got 100 euros. Do I get 110 for this adorable kid that needs a home? Do I get 110? 110 euros to the Free Software Foundation to defend your freedom? Do I get 110 euros? Last chance to bid at least 110 euros. I've got 110. Do I get 110? I've got 110. Do I get 120? 120 euros for this adorable GNU? Do I get 120 euros to the Free Software Foundation to defend your freedom? Do I get 120? Last chance to bid 120. Last chance. Do I get 120? Going, going, gone for 110. Questions. When you ask, please speak loud and clearly and slowly because I'm sort of deaf. No, because I couldn't hear you if you say two things at once. And I couldn't remember them if you said one after the other. So please ask one question.
One of the main contributions of the episode besides the actual software is the DPL license. And given that your speech today was about copyright and freedom in other works, other than software, do you think it is within the scope of the FSF to be a pioneer as it was in the field of software with a license similar to the GPL?
Well, we did. We made the GNU Free Documentation License, which is good for works made for humans to directly appreciate.
Yes, the main... license that people use for works like music and movies these days is the creative, some variation of the
Creative Commons. Well, wait, sorry. Creative Commons publishes six or more different licenses, which are very different.
And are these...
But let me say, first of all, Two of these licenses are free. They are the CC BY license and the CC BY share-alike license. The CC BY share-alike license is a copyleft license, like the GNU GPL. The CC BY license is free but not copyleft. The other four licenses in their principal group are not free, but they all permit sharing. So I think for art, they're all okay. But you shouldn't use any of them for software. And Creative Commons says you should use the GNU GPL for software.
You said in the beginning of your talk that the four freedoms do not fully apply to hardware. How would you apply them to the designs of hardware?
Well, if it's a matter of a design for something to make in a factory, I don't think it matters. Because that's not going to affect us. We don't have factories. On the other hand, when you can make the object with a 3D printer, well, people are starting to get cheap 3D printers. So that starts to become a real issue. And I think that functional parts of the devices must be free if they're designed for people to fabricate. And in fact, those projects that support 3D printing, they should insist on publishing only free designs for works that are functional. And for works that are artistic and decorative, they should only publish shareable designs.
Speaking of the design, I think that it was a few days ago, on the 18th of February, in a specific site called the University, where people publish 3D designs for user and 3D printer. There was a DMCA takedown notice for the breast design. And as far as I know, it was the first attempt to actually take measures against selling 3D designs for using 3D printing.
Do you know what kind of design it was? Was it artistic or was it functional?
It was artistic.
Well, I think that people should be free to share artistic works, but we're going to have to fight for that.
Yeah, basically, my question is that since already the study against serving the 3D designs before the study, what kind of derivative of the license can give us in that regard?
For decorative 3D designs, any Creative Commons license would be okay. For the functional ones, I'd recommend CC Share Alike as a free copyleft license.
Anyone ever told you to stop like my brother?
No. I know that Michael Douglas is or was an actor, but I really know nothing about him other than that. Oh, well. Does that give more credibility to what I say? Give talks, publish articles, write letters to the editor. It's your job. The point is, there is nothing we can do once that would suffice. This is a campaign for freedom, and often such campaigns require work and work and work and work and work for years. I can't hear you. I can't hear you. What did you say?
John Stuart Mill already addressed the fact that every area has its own, challenges to protect individual freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always been there from the beginning.
Yeah. So you're going to have to start working and keep working. That's how we make people aware of it. I've given hundreds of speeches on this talk, on this topic, and I will give many more, assuming I stay alive. So there's a lot of work to be done. Nowadays, there's a tendency to look for the crucial thing that you can do once and it will change the landscape and ensure victory. But you can't expect that. You have to be ready to work. You know, incidents, many famous musicians have talked
about the incidents.
I don't understand what that means. I'm sorry, I'm lost.
That what I mean is that you can use this as an argument.
Well, I can try contacting and asking him and asking him if he wants me to use his name and or if he wants to write this down himself.
Well, if not this particular case, but I'm sure there are other facts or incidents that we could use as an argument.
Maybe so. I don't know how to find them. I guess one possible way is by well, I suppose there's an organization called CIFWA, Science Fiction Writers of America, that a lot of science fiction writers belong to, and maybe that organization would be willing to ask its members to send in stories about how they were mistreated by publishers. That might be interesting.
You know, I'm not just talking about these science fiction.
I know, but I'm thinking, but see, is how to find any substantial number of writers and reach them doesn't seem easy as far as I know. So I thought of CIFWA. Want to do this? Because I don't know how, and I have no time. And I'm flat out. Lots of musicians have started independent record companies because they were fed up with the way they were being exploited by the major ones. Now, if a record company is controlled by some artists, of course it's not going to mistreat them. It's not going to spit on them like as the way the major record companies do. The problem for the small record companies is to get enough money that they could pay any musicians. And so basically, they're either these little ones where they would pay the musicians, but they can't, and there are the big ones that could pay the musicians, but they can also refuse to pay the musicians, so they refuse. Yeah, I mean, if you want to work on this, it might be useful, or someone else who has time can talk with you and find out how to work on this, because it sounds like you know about resources I don't know about. I mentioned CIFWA because it was the only way I could think of to reach a substantial number of writers together. I'm not saying that only science fiction writers are interesting, but reaching a lot of science fiction writers is better than reaching one or two writers by trying to find them when they're making book tours, which is the only other way I can think of. You apparently know a lot more than I do about how this might be approached, so if someone else is interested, maybe you two can talk.
I have another question. You propose new copyright rules, basically, but those rules would still need enforcement.
Yes, but they wouldn't be enforced against people sharing. You see, it's the attempt to stop people from sharing, the war on sharing, that makes copyright enforcement so difficult and so nasty and vicious.
But who would do the enforcement?
Well, the lawyers is more or less the same as now, but if they were not enforcing against the users, sharing, they would have a lot less to do.
You mentioned that you see sharing with, let's say, friends and sharing commercially as different things.
Well, I define sharing as non-commercial.
Okay, sure.
So there's commercial republication, but I don't call that sharing.
Would you say that there are really different things like sharing with friends, sharing with anonymous users on the internet, sharing with anonymous users on the internet, and having some sort of indirect income from that by ads or something like that, and directly?
Well, first of all, non-commercial activity is done using commercial services.
Okay.
That's normal, and that shouldn't be disqualifying. Mm-hmm. So for instance, you're going to have a commercial ISP to connect you to the internet. So what? That doesn't matter. Yes, a distinction can be made between sharing with acquaintances and sharing on the internet. But sharing on the internet is tremendously useful, so it should be legal.
Is there really a difference between... So there was a rumor that the founders of the Pirate Bay got really rich from ads, basically, on the Pirate Bay. Would that be different? Would they be considered commercial sharing?
They didn't... They only put people in touch with each other.
Okay.
To share. So they weren't involved directly in the copying.
Well, they were on the sideline, at least.
So what?
Okay, but I suppose that they were...
But in any case, there are peer-to-peer networks which don't involve anything like the Pirate Bay.
But suppose that people... You are using commercial services, for example, to share with other people, and you...
That's fine.
Yes.
Non-commercial activities can make use of commercial services. That's legitimate in general, and why should we make an exception here? If you want to non-commercially hand out copies of a text, you'll probably need the services of some commercial copying company. That's fine. It's still your distribution of the copies is still non-commercial, even though you have to pay someone else to make them.
Even if you ask the people you've shared with for reimbursement for copies?
Well, then maybe not. That's different.
Okay.
I'm not sure where the boundary should be there, but I think it's an irrelevant question because nobody tries to do that. Not on the internet.
Well, I can see that nobody's trying to do that, but if the...
it wouldn't get started. People are so willing to share without charging, without asking anyone to pay some of their network connection costs. That wouldn't decrease in the future. Network connectivity is only going to get better. So with plenty of people ready to share and not ask for any reimbursement, it's clear that anyone who tried to set up a different sharing service with a reimbursement, it would fail. People would just use the sharing service that doesn't do reimbursement, and everything would be available there, so nobody would use the one that does reimbursement. It's an irrelevant, it's an imaginary possibility that is not worth worrying about, because it can't happen.
I saw an interview recently with Neil Gaiman, faculty author, and he basically tackled the issue of distribution of books, stating in effect that it was beneficial for itself. And due to that, he got more sales from those regions where he wasn't officially being sold. So people had found out about it through reading the comments.
Well, this may well be true. The main benefit that artists, that musicians in particular, get from a record contract is publicity. And sharing copies of the works can give them publicity too. There may be some superstars who saturate everybody's awareness who would lose sales as a result of sharing, but as he pointed out, lots of others, basically those who aren't up at that very rarefied level, are likely to gain.
My big question then, though, is, and it's something I personally find quite irritating, is that the regional restrictions are what caused the copying to happen in the first place.
And I don't know what that means, I'm sorry.
That those basically weren't available for purchase because of publication restrictions in countries like Russia. And that's a very common problem even over here, where we don't have access to certain commercial services, such as, for example, Xbox Live indie games, if we wanted to purchase games through services such as that. That
well, of course, the Xbox Live is a, well, any kind of Xbox is a machine designed to restrict users. It's a malicious product.
Of course, that's just an example. And BBC iPlayer might be another example of...
Well, that's DRM.
Yeah, but it's still region restriction. Restricted content, or even
well, please don't call it content. That calling published works content disparages the works. Now, I have respect for many published works. I don't want to call them content as if they were significant only because they fill up some kind of box. That represents the attitude of the businessman who doesn't care what's in them as long as they sell. Well, they have a right to adopt that point of view, but why should we adopt it? In any case, yes, there are works that are published but restricted by DRM, and that's evil. It's evil because it's a product designed to restrict people. And those, sometimes it's a matter of restricting the access. Sometimes it's a matter of restricting sharing. There are all sorts of different restrictions they can try to make, and they're all wrong.
Would the Free Software Foundation be interested in implementing a system with I like this rhythm you are thinking?
The hard part of that is actually convincing a substantial number of player makers to want to participate, and finding some way to, for the people who would send the money to get some credit to send. If you pass a musician on the street, you can easily give some coins to the musician because you have some coins, but you don't have the coins in case you pass a musician. You have them to use for other things. So that's the biggest problem. And maybe to solve that problem, we have to link this to some other kind of activity that you'd give it, so that you put in some credit for other purposes, but once you have it, you could easily send €1 to a musician from it. The job here to be done is a matter of business negotiation. And it's hard for us because we don't have any contact with those businesses anyway. Well, maybe. There are sites somewhat like that. For instance, there is Jamendo. I think Jamendo allows the users to give money to musicians. The problem, the limit is, the thing that makes it less than a solution is that works for the music that's published on Jamendo. It doesn't work for anything else.
So it's a matter of critical mass.
Partly. It's also, though, a matter of extending it to other things. So if it worked for all music, then it would really work. But I think it might take a government to set this up such and make it actually available for all music. Other questions?
Sorry, just an observation. There's a site called Flutter, that implements something very similar. You donate a certain amount per month, and then you can go to websites and a portion of that and it's distributed among websites or articles or artists.
Hmm. I'd like to look at this. What is it called?
I believe it's called Flutter.
Yes, I have heard about that. I don't remember exactly what I read that did.
Peter Sunde, Pirate Bay.
Yeah.
He started it.
In order for these systems to really become effective, you've got to be able to contribute to just about everything through them.
Well, actually, it lets you embed like a button everywhere on any content you want and associates that with that certain content published work. And so basically, I think it's...
But I presume that this only applies to... works that have been somehow hooked into this particular system?
I haven't used it completely, but as far as I use it a bit, I think it's not bounded to specific content published, but that website. You can even apply it on blog or in a...
Right, but the point is, suppose I listen to a song on the radio, how hard would it be for me to give money for that song? Can I use Flutter to give money for that song?
Well, it implements like a like button. I mean, so...
No, you don't understand. Which songs are connected to it? Which songs could I give money to through Flutter? I would expect that there is a limited set of songs for which somebody has made an arrangement with Flutter.
The authors are responsible for linking their content through Flutter, because they don't have to interact with the company.
Sorry, I don't understand. What does an author do to get paid through Flutter?
They link a button on the web interface or the player interface to their account on Flutter.
Ah, they have to have an account on Flutter.
Yeah.
See, this is what I'm saying. That's the crucial thing. Some people have made accounts on Flutter. Maybe anybody could, but they haven't all.
But I need a bank account to use...
Right, that's the other problem. That's the other problem, that to pay, you have to use e-commerce. So I wouldn't use it myself.
But I need coins to give to you, so...
Yeah.
That's another mechanism to pay.
Yeah, well, the thing is, coins are anonymous. and anybody can carry them.
Give me a pocket.
Yeah. Well, anybody can have pockets. I know that there is some pressure on women not to have pockets, but if you're a feminist, you can resist that pressure. On what? I think the technical issue has already been resolved by David Chong. Digital cash has been designed, but to convince society to adopt anonymous digital cash, that's much harder.
Well, cash isn't anonymous because there's also no coins, all have a serial number.
They could conceivably, but I don't think most merchants are tracking things. And I see them taking bills out of cash registers, and I don't think that they're doing anything to track them. Do you claim that they are? Yeah, but I get my bills most of the time from merchants and pay them to other merchants, so... I get paid sometimes in cash and I spend that money, and it's going to be hard for anyone to track where it went through. But you're right, in theory that's a possible threat we need to be concerned with, and governments are very likely to try to increase their level of surveillance because most governments hate our freedoms. So I think at a deep level you're right that this is an issue. I don't think it has reached an intolerable level yet, but they always might start.
How easy is it to fight for freedom of software when the software is coming bundled with the hardware, and the hardware is the one that is keeping us like that because it comes from the companies?
Well, I can't hear all the words you're saying. I just have a vague idea what you're talking about.
Do you want to repeat?
And yes, we can a lot of hardware, one can replace the software with free software. And in some cases, the hardware is designed specifically to refuse to run the free software, and that's a malicious practice, and people keep on fighting against it.
Yeah, but that means that if we seek for our freedom, then we have to deny our Xbox, our PlayStation.
Absolutely, those are malicious products. Those particular products are malicious. If you want your freedom, well, one prerequisite is don't use those. Well, I think that's partly true, but not totally. You see, not yet, because you see, as far as I know, there isn't DRM in the software in cars. There is proprietary software in cars. And that's a problem. But it isn't yet being designed maliciously.
Absolutely it is.
It is?
Yes. Volkswagen, if you try to chip tune it, it refuses to start. There's a cryptographic chip in it, which checks the signature on the firmware, so to speak.
I see. So this is... And what happens if you replace that cryptographic chip?
Well, everything can be cracked, obviously, but it's not easy. A friend of mine tried it.
Well, that's malicious, yes.
It
couldn't what?
He couldn't get it done. It was too hard for him.
Oh.
And he's a hacker, programmer, kind of guy.
Okay, so they're starting to put malicious features in cars.
Yeah. Stop you from...
What does that mean? I'm sorry, you're saying something I don't recognize.
Well, By chip shooting a vehicle, they're trying to alternate the motor management system to get more horsepower, basically. But it wears out the engine more quickly, which brings problems with the warranty and stuff like that.
Well, it would be perfectly honest for them to say that you void the warranty if you do that.
Sure it is. But they just don't void the warranty, they stop you from doing it.
That's malicious. You should be able to go in and say, I'm voiding my warranty, please remove this.
That would be cool.
So it would be interesting to start a campaign demanding that option.
I think the counter argument already was increase the engine power, increases fuel consumption, which increases the environmental damage. And also increase the fuel consumption, which
That's not a valid argument, because in general, society doesn't consider it, society isn't ready to directly attack individual freedom for the sake of conservation. So why, how?
Cars have labels, and it's very weak in the United States, and taxes, it's very...
Oh, but that's not actually restricting your freedom, that's just taxing. Taxes are not the same thing as forbidding specific actions.
The taxes are based on fuel consumption.
Well, that's fine.
Upgrade is you pay less taxes, more power consumes a lot more fuel. So you basically avoiding taxes.
Now, if they charge the tax through the gasoline, I don't see why they need to tax the vehicle's fuel consumption.
There are also other taxes.
What became of you?
There are also other taxes that the one built the gasoline.
Well, it seems redundant. They could move the taxes to the gasoline price and get the same result. But in any case, they would be honest in saying if you're going to change the tuning of the vehicle, then you have to pay higher taxes. But, you know, you can work that into this, you know, if you go to the company and say, please disable this check, then they will report you need to get a different sticker for pay the higher tax rate.
Yeah, I would like to go back to the example of the flatter service and the IDR users directly or directly. To artists. You say that the problem is that there's no anonymity in the presence of that service where.
I'm pretty sure that's true, because there's no way you could anonymously pay flatter.
So, but how would you do it anonymously? I mean, there always has to be some kind of reserved line.
Well, actually, the encryption technology for doing this was worked out by David Chaum. You can look that up. I don't know if his company was called DigiCash, but I don't know if there's a name for this particular technology. Look up David Chaum, C-H-A-U-M, and you should be able to find it. I knew how it worked, but I forgot it. It's a field that in general, I don't understand well.
What's your feeling on the Android operating system? Is it more a beacon of freedom, or is it slightly away from?
Well, there is a totally free version of Android that's capable of running on the HTC Dream phone.
And the Nexus One?
I heard it wasn't quite working on the Nexus One yet. But indeed, it would be very useful to work on getting it to work on the newer phones. So, yes, it is, in that way, an important contribution to software users' freedom. However, most of the phones that have Android in them have locked it down and forbid users to install modified versions. and that's not acceptable. That's not freedom.
Going back to your idea of always allowing sharing, do you see that as compatible with offering any commercial services over the internet?
Of course it is. What a ridiculous thing to say. I have no idea what you're talking about. What you're talking about makes no sense. There are so many different kinds of commercial services offered on the internet. Like one of them is for buying airline tickets. Sorry, I don't see how allowing sharing is going to cause any trouble at all for selling airline tickets.
Right.
I don't know what you're talking about, but it makes no sense. I think that people will, if it's painless to buy copies and the cost is not so great, a lot of people will just pay that way. They won't be strongly motivated not to.
Yes, I had a question. This evening you have talked about freedom, especially the freedom of users and the freedom also of some authors, and that the big companies such as record companies are probably restrict this freedom. I am wondering, what are your views on freedom of authors that if they do want to implement copyright contracts that you're proposing, are they allowed to do so?
No, they should not be. That's not freedom, that's power. Freedom is having control of your own life. Power is having control over someone else's life. There are things people want that they shouldn't legitimately be able to have, and that you've just identified one of them.
So you're saying your version of copyright law should be mandatory?
I don't know what you mean. Copyright law is mandatory. That's the way it is.
You don't have to.
I don't know what you're talking about. Copyright law gives authors certain stated limited power.
True. You're proposing a 10-year copyright duration.
Yes.
If a certain author would say, I want to do 5 years, and an
author... Oh, well, that's different. Sorry. You said they want, if they wanted to do tougher.
Yeah.
Oh, but that's not tougher, that's more lax. It's the opposite of tougher. Sure, the authors could always waive some of the copyright power that they have.
But what I'm saying is, are you willing to let the authors decide on which duration they choose, or are you saying they should not go above your duration?
I'm saying that I think you have misunderstood the way copyright law works, and what you've stated doesn't have anything to do with copyright law as it is. Copyright law establishes a certain special power over the work, and that power lasts a certain amount of time, according to copyright law. What I'm saying is reduce that amount of time. During that time, the author can use that power, can give up that power, can use it in various ways. What I'm saying is shorten it. And the power will only exist for that shorter period of time. I'm also saying reduce to some extent the power that it gives. So it wouldn't include the power to forbid sharing. But at a deeper level, I'm not proposing to change things. So it would still be a temporary limited power, which the authors could use as they choose. So they could still release things under a license that permits additional things that copyright normally doesn't permit. The authors could still release that way.
I'm just wondering how the short from copyright law would affect copyright licenses like the author.
Oh, well, when the copyright on a work expires, a copyright-based license would cease to matter. It would cease to have any impact because the work's in the public domain. So you bought the GNU. So do you want to collect it now?
No worries. Just getting the there's money for you.
Okay. That's good. So that's how it would relate to copyright-based licenses.
Well, the
copyleft is a way of using copyright law. So copyleft licenses such as the GNU GPL and CC share alike, they all use the copyright. So when the copyright expires, those licenses cease to have any impact, and the work's in the public domain.
Right, but if the work is distributed in binary form, then it's very hard.
Ah, yes. That's one fluke case which applies only to software. Now, I believe software should all be free. The software is in the category of works that do practical jobs. I don't see any particular reason to allow proprietary software. I don't campaign to prohibit it because I think that's too radical a step to take by law today. But I see no reason to object to such a law. If most people wanted to ban proprietary software, I wouldn't campaign against that. I don't expect that to happen soon. Well, I think that if copyright lasts 10 years, that's long enough. Because 10-year-old software is not that useful. Sorry, what?
They are running a 40-year-old
code. Are you sure? How many of them? I mean, do you mean that? But in any case, I have a suspicion that you've just said something that totally misrepresents the facts you're referring to. Do you mean that certain individual companies have code that they developed 40 years ago and they're still using it? Yes, well, that's a totally unrelated case. That's not a published work at all. 10-year-old software is not very useful for making products because you'd want to use something newer, which will be better. These companies, they didn't make that software as a product. They just made it to use it. So they don't have much reason to improve it except when their needs change and they're forced to change it, and they don't like to have to do that, but sometimes they have to. But aside from that, because it's not a product, they're not under any pressure to improve it. They're not competing with anybody.
Not that I disagree with you, but just for the sake of argument.
For the sake of argument, let's not have an argument, okay? It's an artificial, phony argument just for the sake of argument. I'd rather do something else. No, I'm not interested in what they think. I don't think we should leave it up to them. I'm saying the rest of us should say we're not willing to be restricted in that fashion, and we're going to end the prohibition on sharing, and never mind whether the person who used to have that power regrets having it taken away from him. There are times when you just have to disregard what somebody thinks if he's treating us badly. And that's the case when anybody tries to forbid sharing. He's doing something wrong and hostile to society. So we first of all have to stop that problem. And we don't have to convince the current holders of that power to like giving it up before we take it away.
But they would try to convince everybody.
They can try. The point is, we've got to get organized. We've got to defeat them.
I have a question about the literature. You distinguished three types in it.
Three types of works, regardless of medium. So literature can be in any of these three categories. Music is typically art, but I suppose there could be educational music too.
So you have the art, the
stuff to get work done. And the
statements that represent someone's views.
Yeah, okay. About that one. You want to use copyright to keep people from changing it. Because someone puts his name on the line when publishing it.
Its purpose is to represent the views of particular people.
Okay, well, the thing is, we really need copyright for it. Because if you say, these are statements made by so-and-so people, and that's not true, you're lying.
Well, yes, you're lying, but I don't think lying is typically a crime. Well, now that's a much bigger change you're proposing, and I think it's a topic for a different day's discussion.
No, it's already a crime to do something.
No, it's only in certain special contexts. Maybe lying in court is a crime, but in general, I don't think it's a crime to misrepresent someone.
Making false statements in a document, does bring that what kind of document can be a crime?
Well, maybe sometimes, if it's for official purposes, maybe. But other than that, I don't think so.
I just wanted to check if I got your idea of sharing, right? Let's say you bought DRM with music, movie, or ebook, and so you have no, according to your ideas, there should be no problem in sharing with all of us here.
That's right.
This, or even sending it to the
end. Yes, that's right. So, I think I will call a halt to the questions because I've been going on for a long time. Okay, one more. But who would it be? Who has asked? He hasn't asked, so.
How do you make money with your UPL software?
Well, lots of people are paid to write GPL-covered software. Sometimes there are companies whose business is developing solutions, and in the process they improve some free software. There are also people who work for large companies and get paid to improve some free software. There may be other ways as well, I don't know.
But you need others who pay you.
Well, obviously, to make money you've got to be paid by somebody else. You can't make money by paying yourself.
Okay, but I want to make, make money by selling it.
Well, you're allowed to do so, but in practice nowadays that doesn't seem to work. It worked for me in 1985, but nowadays for most things it's so easy to download that you won't be able to sell physical copies for a lot of money.
I don't think it's true, because in the music industry, the Pro Tools and Ableton Live and such software.
Sorry, I can't hear what you're saying now. You disagree with me, so you think it is possible to sell make money by selling copies of GPL-covered software?
No. I'm not speaking about GPL now.
Okay, well, that was what your question was. I mean, so you're changing the subject. I think that's a side issue. You see, if a program is not free, then it's an attack on your freedom right there. And if you want to have control of your computing, the only way to do it is by not using non-free software. So it really makes no difference how effective non-free software could be as a business strategy, because it's inherently bad for the user. And once you recognize that, if you value freedom, you're not going to accept it. And so to argue that there's some advantage in the fact that it's easier for someone to make money for it is like saying we should eat poison because it's cheaper to make.
Money
can
give you freedom.
Well, non-free software can't give you freedom. It's not compatible with your freedom. So if you have a business making non-free software, I'm not a customer. I wouldn't take it if you paid me. Because running it would mean giving up my freedom. I, as it happens, care about freedom enough, I'm willing to make big sacrifices, like work for years to get freedom. So I'm sure that I could have used Unix and I wouldn't have had to pay. In fact, I could have stayed at MIT and MIT would have paid me to use Unix, but I wouldn't have had freedom. So I decided I was going to write a replacement for Unix, even though that was many years of work. So what difference does it make whether someone can make money developing proprietary software? All that means is there is a problem we've got to do something about. If it didn't make any money, everybody would stop and the problem would solve itself automatically. Well, that would be nice, but it isn't so. So the problem of proprietary software is one that we need to make an effort to put an end to. And the first step is to recognize that for our own sake, we shouldn't be using it. I said one more, so no, we can go on.
Today's law?
I'll write that.
Anyone wants to join the free software?